In the beginning, public radio was a little stuffy.
WUOM, the broadcasting service of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, begins its broadcast day.
Today, Michigan radio was one of the most popular radio stations in the state. But fans of National Public Radio can thank WUOM for the fact that NPR even exists. In the 1960s, WUOM was an educational radio station. Jack Mitchell was the news director at the station in those days. Today, he's a journalism professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he admits the station was not very exciting.
WUOM was a little bit sleepy, and it was very educational in its tone. We broadcast lectures, but the main reason people listened to the station was classical music.
In those days, the darling of educational broadcasters was television. Politicians, universities, and foundations held out great hope for television's ability to educate, instruct, and promote culture. Radio was so yesterday.
Well, radio was dead. It had never met its expectations as an educational force. And the Ford Foundation had been the primary national funder of public radio and public television. And the Ford Foundation decided that it was spreading its money too widely and that it should focus its money on the things that had a chance to succeed, and that did not include radio.
The Ford Foundation was not alone in dismissing radio. When the Carnegie Commission published a 1967 report that recommended federal funds for public television, radio was nowhere in the document. But three crusty old radio guys from the University of Michigan fought hard, and sometimes dirty, to get federal support for radio. Station manager Edward G. Burroughs and program director Gerald Sandler waged what historians called a guerrilla operation to get radio in what was originally called the Public Television Act. In an oral history recorded in 1978, Sandler said he knew the importance of getting radio in that original legislation.
In order for you to get a piece of the action, you've got to be in the basic legislation.
Burroughs and Sandler successfully lobbied to get radio included in the Public Television Act. They got help from another former WUOM employee. Dean Costin was a deputy undersecretary at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and drafted the legislation. But the day before the legislation left President Johnson's office, Sandler got a Saturday afternoon phone tip that told him radio was not in the legislation.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I was incredulous. How could that be? So I called Dean Costin at home. I said, Dean, I've never asked you for any special favors during this entire legislative process, but you must check one fact out. And I told him about the conversation. Sunday at about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, my phone rang. And what I heard at the other end of the phone was a very tired Dean Costin who said, you miserable SOB. He'd been up all that day and all that night because, in fact, radio had been taken out, and they had to put it back all over again.
Jack Mitchell says it took all night to write in radio by hand.
Every time television was there, he just put in a carrot and stuck in radio. They just put in the words, and radio, and radio, and radio.
Putting radio in the bill meant there was money for public radio when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was formed. That money became the startup dollars for a tiny network called NPR. Mitchell says the people who wrote public radio off in the 1960s would never have guessed at its future strength and audience.
It's very ironic that radio didn't seem to be any chance of succeeding. And, of course, in the long run, public radio has a rather bright future, and public television is more marginal.
But Burroughs and Sandler both paid a price for their radio battle. Neither of them ever played a role in the national organization again, despite attempts to get jobs at NPR. But on this birthday of Michigan radio, we should remember those men from WUOM who made NPR possible. I'm Vincent Duffy, Michigan Radio News.